somehow shape the future. I would hope and pray I'd touch lives by the way I live today. Just one life. I want to leave a legacy. Years from now they'll see that I live only for the cause of Christ. Oh, to make a difference by living day to day as a.
Hey everyone, this is Steve Donahue bringing you another episode of the Legacy Podcast, helping you build your legacy. This is episode number 234, and this is going to be an exposition of Esther chapter 9 and 10 that I recently preached to the church in which I pastor, Mount Tabor Baptist Church. Stay tuned for that. This, of course, is a great exposition on the last chapters of the book, and it's a great testimony of the grace of God and the power of God to be able to work in the lives of His people. Before we do that, I just want to take care of a little business. First of all, make sure that you're a registered user. There's a link on the webpage as well as on the website itself for that. Also, if you're not yet subscribed through iTunes or one of the other media host features, you can do that, and I encourage you to do that. Best way of supporting the show is by becoming a Legacy Partner through our Legacy Partner program. You can find out the details of that in the show note link as well as on the webpage itself. And then also, if you've not yet been over the homeschoolhope.com webpage and listened to some of the podcasts I have over there, I encourage you to do that, particularly if you are a homeschooler or considering homeschool. And then finally, if you would like to support the show without any additional costs, you can go through some of our affiliates. And that way, I will get a little bit of commission on anything you purchase through them. Our affiliates are U.S. Legal Forms, 48 Days, Amazon, Liberty Classroom, and Covenant Eye. So I thank you for your support and your encouragement, but mostly I thank you for listening. So here you go. Well, indeed, it is Mother's Day, and it is a great opportunity to celebrate mothers. And, you know, one of the challenges that pastors have on a regular basis is when we come across holidays like Mother's Day and Father's Day and Easter and Christmas and things like that. Easter and Christmas is a little bit easier. But everybody always expects you to preach a Mother's Day sermon. Well, there are only a few places in the Scriptures that you can turn to, really, to get a good text for a Mother's Day sermon. And so you're not going to hear a Mother's Day sermon today. We're going to continue with the book of Esther, although there are some parallels, I think, because we will see here in the book of Esther that we read today that there was a great celebration that took place as a result of what occurred in the life of the Jewish people under the Persian Empire and under Esther's leading. And of course, today is a great day of celebration, particularly for mothers. Now, sometimes there are holidays that are developed, I think, for Hallmark. Some of you know this. Did you know that if you were to celebrate every Hallmark holiday, we'd never go to work? It seems like there's a holiday every weekend for something, for somebody. And I think a part of that, of course, is so that you can buy cards for everybody. I mean, there's neighborhood days, and there's grandmother and grandparent days, and there's children days. And I mean, there's all kinds of days. And yet there are some that are set aside particularly for special. And I think it's honorable. I think it's a good thing for us to celebrate our mothers and to appreciate them. We should appreciate them, of course, every day, as the Scriptures tell us to honor our fathers and our mothers. But it's nice to set aside a particular day in which we make an intentional effort to honor them more than we normally would. And so it is a good thing to celebrate in times like that. And what we'll see today in the book of Esther is that there is another celebration that took place among the people of God under the Persian Empire that was significant. So significant, in fact, that it's celebrated among the Jews even today. And we will see that today. There are really two heads of these two chapters. And the first one is in verses 1 through 16. And it's this: the Jews defend themselves. The Jews defend themselves. We've seen this hinted at already in chapter 8 as the decree was written for them to be able to defend themselves on the very day in which the original decree was written for their annihilation. And we see that actually taking place here in this chapter. Now, chapter 9, verse 1 is really a summary statement. It indicates that on that particular day, on that month of Adar, which would be the last month of the year, it would be actually coinciding most of the time with our March. They ended their year, it made more sense, they ended their year at the end of winter. And they started the new year in spring, right? We got things confused. We start ours beginning, or right in the dead of winter, we start a new year. That doesn't make any sense. But anyway, the Jews started theirs at the beginning of spring, and so we see them starting here. And at the end of that year, this was to take place. It would have been March, the summary statement here. And I think it's interesting to note what it was. And that was the very opposite of the original decree is what took place. The tables were turned. Although it was supposed to be a day in which all the Jews were annihilated, the exact opposite is what took place. And so in verse 2 it says this: the Jews gathered together in the cities throughout all the provinces of King Ahasuerus to lay hands on those who sought their harm, and no one could withstand them because fear of them fell upon all people. Now, there's a couple of things that need to be pointed out here. First of all, this is what was a united defense. It says that all the people gathered together, all the Jews gathered together. Now, this was significant because had they not gathered together, if there was a few that were straggling around, they probably would have been slaughtered. But because they were united and because they gathered together, they were able to have a force that was defensible. Also, it says that they gathered throughout all the province. This was not only a united, but it was a universal defense. All throughout the provinces, they gathered together. It was also a targeted defense. Notice here it says that they targeted only those who sought their harm. In other words, they weren't going to overthrow the entire Persian Empire. It was just to defend themselves against those who wanted their harm. And of course, then we also see that it was an effective defense. No one could withstand them, it says, because the fear of the Jews was upon them. And so verse 3, it says, and all the officials of the province, the satraps, the governors, and all those doing the king's work helped the Jews because the fear of Mordecai fell upon them. Now, this was probably hyperbole in that probably not every single person in the kingdom helped the Jews, but very often the scriptures, when it's talking about the vast majority, so many so that it made a big impact, is kind of what the idea is here. And they helped them. We don't know exactly how they helped them. We don't know whether they gave them arms in which to fight. We don't know whether they actually fought with them or whether they provided intel and said, that person over there is one of those who hates you. We don't know exactly. We're not told how they helped them. But it seems to be that throughout all the kingdom, it wasn't just the Jews that were taking part in this, but it was very many of the other people as well that were helping the Jews. And it says the reason why, of course, is because the fear of Mordecai had fallen upon them, because Mordecai, it says in verse 4, had become great in the king's palace. He had risen to such a level that the whole empire knew who Mordecai was and knew that he was a Jew, and the fear of God was upon them as they feared Mordecai. Verse 5, it says this: thus the Jews defeated all of their enemies with the stroke of the sword, with slaughter and with destruction, and did what pleased to those who hated them. And so there was a complete destruction of those who hated them. Again, this is a summary statement. It's limited, though, in verse 10, verse 15, and verse 16. We'll see that there is a repeated phrase, and that is, it says, but they left the plunder alone. In other words, they didn't do it all that they wanted to do. They probably wanted to take the plunder, but they prevented themselves from doing that. And we'll see some of the reasons probably for that. And I also think it's interesting to note that as we'll go through this and you'll see, it seems to indicate that not one of the Jews was harmed. It was a complete annihilation on the other side, and God had preserved every one of them. And so verse 6, it says, and Shushan the citadel, the kings killed and destroyed 500 men. Now, I'm not going to read all the other names that are listed there in verses 7 through 9, but these are the 10 sons of Haman. And they were captured, and then later they were executed themselves. And so 500 men in the city of Shushan, as well as the 10 sons of Haman were killed. But again, it says in verse 10, but they did not lay a hand on the plunder. They did not lay a hand on the plunder, probably because they did not want to be accused of ulterior motives. They were just defending themselves. They didn't want to be accused of taking the other people's property or killing in behalf of being able to gain riches from it. It reminds me of earlier when Abraham would conquer a place and he defended himself or defended his cousin Lot, nephew Lot, against some of the kings there. And they took the plunder, and he wouldn't take any of the plunder because he didn't want to consider it having gained by that. And so we see an example here similarly. I think it's interesting to note here that what the Jews do with this passage when it talks about Haman's sons. In fact, if you were to go to a synagogue and you were to hear this passage being read in a synagogue today, which they do every year on the Feast of Purim, they read the book of Esther. And when it comes to the names of Haman here, they read them all in one breath because they were all killed together. And I think it's also interesting to note that if you were to look in a Hebrew scroll or they would look in the Hebrew text, there would be two names in bold and larger print. And each of the two names, there would be five listed here, two by two. And the only other place in the scriptures where the scribes of the Old Testament recorded names like this is in Joshua chapter 12. Verses 9 through 24, which lists the Canaanite kings that were defeated by the Israelites. And so it seems to be that this was a particularly important point that God was pointing out to the people of Israel, that these were the enemies of the Jews that were being killed. And these were like the head of the enemies of the Jews. Haman, of course, has already been killed. These were his 10 sons who, no doubt, wanted to continue the work of Haman. And so verse 11 says, on that day, the number of those who were killed in Shushan the city was brought to the king. And the king said to Queen Esther, the Jews have killed and destroyed 500 men in Shushan the citadel and the 10 sons of Haman. What have they done in the rest of the king's provinces? Now, I'm not sure whether the king didn't know this or whether he did know it. And he was just making an expression to indicate that she had completed what she had wanted and to find out if she had wanted anything more, which he then asked. He says, now, what is your petition? And it shall be granted you. What is your further request? And it shall be done. So verse 13, then Esther said, if it pleases the king, let it be granted to the Jews who are in Shushan to do again tomorrow, according to the decree today. So apparently in all the other provinces besides Shushan, the capital, all of the enemies have been killed. But in Shushan, there still remain some. I don't know why they weren't able to kill them off the first day. Maybe they weren't able to find out who they were, and some had arisen or been hiding or something like that. And so they asked the king for another day in which to complete the slaughter of their enemies. And so verse 14, so the king commanded it to be done, and a decree was issued in Shushan, and they hanged Haman's 10 sons, which also was one of her requests in verse 13. And so everything that she asks for, she's getting. He gives them another day in which to defend themselves so that she might and they might be able to complete the destruction. So verse 15, they complete the destruction. The Jews who were in Shushan gathered together again on the 14th day of the month of Adar and killed 300 men in Shushan, but they did not lay a hand again on the plunder. So that brings the total in Shushan to 800 and the 10 sons of Haman. And they didn't take the plunder once again. So verse 16, the remainder of the Jews in the king's provinces gathered together and protected their lives, had rest from their enemies, and killed 75,000 of their enemies. That is indeed a significant number, is it not? That means that a couple of things. One, it means that there was a lot of people who wanted to kill off the Jews. This wasn't just a handful of people. It wasn't just Haman and his family. This was a significant number of people who wanted the Jews dead in Persia. But it also shows something significant too, and that is that the slaughter of the Jews was powerful. God had given them such ability to be able to destroy in one day 75,000 of their enemies in Persia, and then the leftovers in Shushan. So the number here actually comes out to be about 600 per province, a little bit less than 600 per province. This was a significant slaughter. So what are some important principles that are illustrated here? I mean, obviously, we don't live in Persia. We weren't a part of this. And so what can we learn from this as a way of application for us today? Well, one thing I think that we should be reminded of in this, and that is that unity brings strength. Unity brings strength. Notice that they were united together. They had gathered together among themselves and all throughout the province in order to exercise this strength. There is indeed strength in unity. In fact, in Ecclesiastes chapter 4, verses 9 through 12, it says this, "Two are better than one because they have a good reward for their labor. For if they fall, one will lift up his companion. But woe to him who is alone when he falls, for he has no one to help him up. Again, if two lie down together, they will keep warm. But how can one be warm alone? Though one may be overpowered by another, two can withstand him. And a threefold cord is not quickly broken." There is indeed strength in number. Jesus is arguing with the Pharisees that he could not be casting out demons by the demons himself in Matthew chapter 12, verse 25, when he says this, "Every kingdom divided against itself is brought to desolation, and every city or house divided against itself will not stand." Why? Because there's strength in number. Unity brings strength. You know, we are a divided nation today, aren't we? In fact, we're divided along political lines. You're either Republican or you're Democrat. And if you try to be something in between, you get squished into one of those, don't you? I mean, that's the way it works. And that's the way our system works. And in fact, our media tries to get you to be Republican. I get political calls all the time, as you probably do as well, especially as the time for campaigning gets underway, and as that will be soon. You'll get calls. And this is the way they usually work in my house. You know, it'll be a call, and this is such and say polling company or whatever, and would you mind taking a political poll? Well, I always like to take political polls because I like to harass the people. But anyway, they do a political poll, and they say, "So are you planning on voting in the upcoming election?" And usually I say yes. "Are you planning on voting Republican or Democrat?" And what do I say to that? I usually say, "Neither one." And then they say, "So are you planning on voting for the Republican candidate or the Democratic candidate?" And I say, "Neither one." And they say, "Well, thank you for the poll." They don't know what to do with that. Why? Because we are supposed to be divided in our country. That's what everybody wants, is for us to be divided. Well, is there strength in that? Nope. There's no strength in that. What about a house? You know, in our culture, we have been taught to divide up in our house, haven't we? Junior goes this way to his activities. Juniorette goes that way to her activities. Dad goes out to his shop, and Mom goes over here. Isn't that true? And we wonder why our families are falling apart. There's no unity. Some of the strongest families that I have seen are those who are united around something. Maybe they are a group that sings together or something, or they're a group that does something else together. Why? Because they're united together. There's strength in unity. And we look at the church. Now, I believe that the Protestant Reformation was a good thing for the church overall. But one of the arguments against it was that if we let everybody interpret the scripture, there's going to be hundreds of denominations. Well, guess what? There are hundreds of denominations. The church is all split up. Now, one of the things I like about Southern Baptists is that we consider ourselves independent in the sense that we are an independent church. The James River Association or the Southern Baptist Convention doesn't dictate to us what we are to do here in our church, which is a good thing. But at the same time, as the Southern Baptist churches, we cooperate together so that through missions giving and through other means of cooperation, we can actually unite together to achieve a purpose. That's what we should do. But that's what we should not only do among Southern Baptists, but we should be doing that among all different kinds of denominations as long as they believe the Bible in order to accomplish what we can, because there is unity in strength. And then second thing I think that we should understand from this is that infighting keeps us from fighting the real enemy. Infighting keeps us from fighting the real enemy. I wonder what would have happened had the Jews fought among themselves rather than fought against the real enemy, they wouldn't have survived, would they have? Part of uniting together is agreeing that there is an enemy outside of that group in which to fight. How does this apply to the Christian life? Ephesians chapter 6, verse 12 says this, "For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in heavenly places." You see, our battle is not against people of the flesh. Our battle is against the spiritual hosts of wickedness in heavenly places. Our battle is against the demons and the head of the demons, which is Satan. And yet sometimes we think that our fight is against our neighbor. Or our fight is against the Republicans. Or our fight is against the Democrats. It's not, is it? Our fight as Christians is on a spiritual level. It is a spiritual battle in which we are engaged. Now my kids fight all the time. It's something that drives me crazy. And I am really trying to work on preventing that, but it is a real challenge and a real source of pain in our home. And why is it that people fight? Well, the scriptures tell us in James chapter 4, verses 1 through 3, where do wars and fights come from among you? Do they not come from your desires for pleasure and that war in your members? You lust and you do not have. You murder and covet and cannot obtain. You fight and war, yet you do not have because you do not ask. And you ask and you do not receive because you ask amiss that you may spend it on your pleasures. See, what is the cause of fighting, infighting with people that should be united together? It's selfishness. It's a desire for things for yourself. People fight all the time among themselves because we are using up our energy that should be used against the real enemy. In counseling, in marriage counseling, very often a couple will come and they will be fighting with each other. And they'll be pointing the finger at each other and saying, "Well, she did this, and he did this, and she did this, and he did this." And you've probably experienced some of that in your own marriage, I'm sure. And until the couple comes together and realizes we're on the same team, fighting against an issue or fighting against something else, they'll never be able to find peace. And yet the reality of it is they are united. They are together. And we are to address the real cause and the real issue. So what is our real fight against? Our real fight is against the spiritual forces of wickedness. Let's not spend our time in worthless skirmishes with those who are not really our enemy. Rather, let us apply our energies and our resources in fighting against the spiritual hosts of wickedness in heavenly places. Thirdly, I want us to see that the source of our strength is the Lord. The source of our strength is the Lord. It wasn't for the Jews that they had swords of special power. It wasn't that they had a particularly large number of people that was on their side, although they did. The source of their strength was the Lord, and so it is with us. I think it's interesting to note, it says that fear fell on so many of the Persians because of Mordecai's position. And how did Mordecai get the position that he did? By the grace of God. It was because God showed favor to Esther and God showed favor to Mordecai. And so by that grace, they were able to elevate to a certain position. So the hand of God was all over. If you recall, the book of Esther is very unique because never is God mentioned in it. It's the only book in all the Bible where God's name is not used. And yet it's very, very clear that God is all over the events that are taking place in the book of Esther. And so the strength of the Lord is what gives them the ability to be able to fight and defend themselves. Now, this is not unprecedented in the way in which the Lord works among God's people. I'm reminded of Joshua, who, by marching around Jericho and blowing some trumpets and marching around and praising God, he was able to make the walls of Jericho fall down and totally annihilate the inhabitants of Jericho. Or I'm reminded of Gideon, who with 300 men defeated the Midianites and the Amalekites and all the people of the east. And in Judges chapter 7, verse 12, it says that they were as numerous as locusts, and their camels were without number as the sand of seashore in multitude. And they were defeated by 300 men. What does that teach us? Power is not in might. The power is not in numbers. The power is not in some ability that we might have. The power is in the Lord. And so Psalm 27, verses 1 through 6 says this, "The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the strength of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? When the wicked came against me to eat up my flesh, my enemies, my foes, they stumbled and fell. Though an army may encamp against me, my heart shall not fear. Though war may rise against me, in this I will be confident. One thing I have desired of the Lord, that will I seek, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to behold the beauty of the Lord and to inquire in his temple. For in the time of trouble he shall hide me in his pavilion, in the secret place of his tabernacle he shall hide me. He shall set me high upon a rock, and now my head shall be lifted up above my enemies all around me. Therefore I will offer sacrifices of joy in his tabernacle. I will sing praises to the Lord." Why? Because the Lord is our strength. If we fight against God, we will not stand. But when God fights with us, we will not fall. My friends, we do not fight in our might, but we fight in the might of the Lord. So that's the first division. The second division we see in the text is that the Jews celebrate God's deliverance. The Jews celebrate God's deliverance. We see this beginning in verse 17 and 18 and continuing through the end of the book. And in verse 17 it says this, "This was on the 13th day of the month of Adar. On the 14th of the month they rested and made it a day of feasting and gladness." Now the natural response to a restoration or self-preservation or the victory that comes to our lives is a resting and a feasting and a gladness. Ecclesiastes chapter 3 verse 4 tells us that there is a time to weep, there is a time to laugh, there is a time to mourn, and there is a time to dance. Earlier in the book we see them mourning in sackcloth and ashes. Here we see them rejoicing and celebrating. Verse 18 it says, "But the Jews who were in Shushan assembled together on the 13th day as well as on the 14th day. And on the 15th day they rested and made a day of feasting and gladness." We're not told why all the enemies were not killed the first day, but apparently they were not. And so they had to delay some of their feasting and gladness until they had completed the task one more day. Verse 19, "Therefore the Jews of the village who dwelt in the unwalled town celebrate the 14th day of the month of Adar with gladness and feasting as a holiday and for sending presents to one another." So we're told a little bit more about how they participated in this feast. They not only rested and feasted with gladness, but they also made it a holiday, sending of presents and so forth. And more details are given in verses 20 through 22 about what actually is to take place and the requirements that are given there. And we're not going to read all of that. In fact, all the way through verse 27 we read earlier, and you can read that again on your own, but talks about what is to require as a part of the celebration that takes place here on this Purim. And I think it's interesting to note a couple of things. First of all, it was based on a historical event. They allowed this celebration, or they required this celebration to be done because it demonstrated what took place in history. And I think that's important for us because it reminds us that God is at work in history. It was made a big deal. It was not just a small celebration. There was giving of gifts. It was a great and huge celebration. And it was so that history would not repeat itself, but that people could be reminded of God's act and his work in history. And it's good with those who are in authority actually do good with that authority. And we see here that being the case. Although Ahasuerus often is a passive ruler, he allows those under him to do some good things and some bad things. And when the rulers are good, they do good. And when the rulers are bad, they do bad. And here we see Esther and Mordecai doing actually what is good and glorifying God through these laws. Incidentally, Adolf Hitler banned and forbade the observance of Purim. And in a speech made on November 10th, 1938, Julius Streicher surmised that just as the Jews, this is a quote, "the Jews butchered 75,000 Persians in one night, in the same the same fate would have befallen the German people had the Jews succeeded in inciting the war against the Germans. And so they thought that the Jews were going to kill off the Germans like they did the Persians. Of course, they had no intentions of doing that, but it gave them an excuse, of course, to try to exterminate the Jews. So verse 29, we see Queen Esther writing a law indicating that this was to be celebrated. And I think it's interesting to note here that the way in which this is written in the Hebrew, it is indicating that she was actually the one that wrote the law. Very unusual in those days for women to write laws, and yet here it indicates that she wrote this law. And then, of course, in Esther chapter 10, verses 1 through 3, we see Ahasuerus imposing tribute on the land and the island and the sea. This is an indication of his far-reaching empire and how powerful he was, and an indication that the Jews contributed to his power and to his might as a ruler. I personally find it interesting that if you look at the book of Esther, the only thing the king can really do is pass laws and impose taxes. Nothing's really changed in that period of time, has it? And then in verse 2, it says, "Now all these acts were written down in the chronicles of the Medes and the Persians." Wouldn't it be great if the archaeological spade would uncover that book sometime? Talk about uncovering something that testifies to the glory of God. Wouldn't it be great if they were able to uncover the minutes of the kings of Persia and to be able to identify exactly what took place according to the scriptures here? And then finally in verse 3 it says, "For Mordecai the Jew was second in the king Ahasuerus and was great among the Jews, well received by the multitude of his brethren, seeking the good of his people and speaking peace to all his countrymen." Indeed, God did a great work in Mordecai in being able to allow him to do these things and to be raised up as he was. And so what can we apply with reference to these last verses of the book of Esther? Well, I think one thing is that it teaches us about celebration. It teaches us about celebration. First of all, celebrate. We are to celebrate what God has done immediately. We're to celebrate immediately. I think it's interesting to note here, they didn't wait to celebrate. They only waited until the actual activity was completed, and then as soon as it was completed, the very next day, they celebrated. Well, why is that? I think sometimes we wait too long until we actually forget, and the activity is no longer important to us. Why is it good to celebrate? Well, they actually get around to it. It reminds me of Luke chapter 17. If you recall Luke chapter 17, Jesus heals 10 lepers that come to him. And he heals all of them, tells them to go and wash in the river and to show themselves to the Pharisees and the scribes. And they go, and it says, as they were going, all 10 were healed. But then it says, one came back to give him thanks. And it says this was a foreigner. Apparently, that ones may have been Jews. And, of course, the point is that they were all supposed to come back. Well, why didn't they all come back? It was probably the other ones meant to. They just didn't. And isn't that true with us a lot of times? We mean to give God praise. We mean to give God thanks. We will do it. But we just never get around to it. That's why it's important to celebrate immediately when it comes on. And we fix it in time and place. Sometimes we look back at our history and we think, well, I think it happened on this date, but I'm not sure. It may have been like this. What, you know? And we don't know exactly when things happened because we don't fix them in time. And one of the ways we fix them in time, of course, is we make a celebration immediately. Now, I grew up in the 70s and the 80s, and there was a song that was often played by Kool and the Gang. And when I mentioned it to my wife, you know the song, Celebrate Good Times, right? She said, "You're not going to sing that, are you?" So, no, I'm not going to sing it. But you can sing it if you want. No, I'm just kidding. But some of the lyrics go like this. Celebrate good times. Come on. You know, I'm not going to sing the rest of it. But you know the idea, right? The idea is that we are to celebrate. Now, if a secular singer can sing about the times to celebrate, shouldn't we as God's people celebrate the great events that God has done in our life? Absolutely, we should. We celebrate when our ball team wins. Should we not celebrate when there's a spiritual victory? Of course we should. And secondly, I think this teaches us that we are to celebrate what God has done extravagantly. Extravagantly. I think it's interesting to note here that the Jews didn't hold anything back in their celebration. It wasn't as though they were just like, you know what, let's just have a day of feasting tomorrow. What does it say? It says that they rested, they feasted, they made it a holiday, they spent time giving gifts to one another and giving gifts to the poor. They went all out on their feasting. It was a great day of celebration. And you know, today this is done among the Jews as well. In fact, if you were to be among the Jewish community on a day of Purim that is celebrated today, you would think it's much like Halloween. Many of the children dress up as either Haman, or they dress up as Mordecai or Esther, and they act the play out, and they roll dice, which were Purim, you know, these kind of things, and they reenact the whole thing. They make it a big deal. Why? So it might be fixed into their mind. So it might be a steadfast reminder. Now, we celebrate things in the Christian calendar as well. We celebrate Easter and we celebrate Thanksgiving. Of course, that's not in the Christian calendar. We celebrate Christmas. Now, there are some Christians who don't believe that we should celebrate those things, that, you know, they had pagan origins and all this kind of stuff. But why not celebrate? Why not celebrate the events that God has set in place for his people? And then thirdly, celebrate what God has done perpetually. Celebrate what God has done perpetually. The idea behind this is that it is to be done so that generations will follow, will learn what has taken place in that generation. They took a great effort to make sure that it was a memorial event and passed on from one generation to the next. When we celebrate what God has done in our life, we should think multi-generationally. It reminds me of Psalm 78, verses 5 and 6. For it says, He has established a testimony in Jacob and appointed a law in Israel, which he commanded our fathers that they should make it known to their children, that the generation to come might know them, the children who would be born, that they may arise and declare it to their children. Four generations were in mind in that psalm. And that's the way that we should approach the events that God is doing in our life. We should make a testimony of them so that our children after them would be able to know that God is indeed at work in our lives and that we can celebrate those things even to the day. Part of passing on the faith is explaining the significance of God working out his details in our life and passing those things down. Sometimes we are opposed to traditions. And sometimes traditions can be caught up to where people forget the meaning behind the tradition. But that doesn't mean we should throw out the traditions. What it means is that we should just continue to emphasize the importance of the significant event that took place that made for the tradition itself. And so we see here the celebration that is taking place among the Jews. But I think that there is one thing by way of conclusion that we must be reminded of as we close out the book of Esther, and that is the providential hand of God. There is more to just saving a few people's lives in the time of Esther that is taking place. Because if you recall, it is the Jews who were to bring in the Messiah. Had the Jews been killed off under the Persian Empire, there'd be no Messiah. But because God in his providence preserved the people under the Persian Empire, they were able to bring forth the Messiah. And because the Messiah was able to bring forth, there was a victory over sin for you and for me. The gates of hell will not prevail against the church, the scriptures say. And when we read of persecutions around the globe, when we read of people being put to death even this day for their faith, we can gain encouragement knowing that the gates of hell will not prevail against the church. In the end, God gets the victory. Let us come together to fight against the real enemy of the church, and that is the devil and his hosts. Let us celebrate the victories that God has given to us, and let us have absolute confidence in the providential hand of God. Let us pray.
I think that it's time We start crying for our nation and bow our heads and pray. If today you lost your life, what would you leave behind? What would the ones around you see? What happened in the dash between your birth and death? What will you do to change your legacy? Just like the plant that withers away, we will leave many seeds behind. If today you lost your life, what would you leave behind? What would the ones around you see? What happened in the dash between your birth and death? What will you do to change your legacy? What will you do to change your legacy?